I know. I keep mentioning the new book, but I'm still going into tonight. The problem is that it keeps changing. The good idea fairy hit me over the weekend while I was riding a bike with the boys, and what started as a little nice, neat space cop police procedural novel taken place across the galaxy is now looking more like a galaxy-wide civil war. And it's not because I stir shit up, that's just because that's what the characters building in my head decided. There's apparently a ton of corruption rotting the government within the core planets, and that corruption is costing the hard-working settlers out in the far-off range of the galaxy their lives. And these hard-working folks are about to start pushing back, and my guy is now right smack in the middle of it. So on Friday, I was thinking that I'd be wrapping up my first draft by about April-ish. And now it looks more like it's probably going to be June, because of all the new work I've given myself. So we'll see what the good idea fairy has to say about my timeline. But once I figure out what this new book is actually going to be about, I will be more than happy to tell you all about it. So more to follow on that. But before we get started tonight, go pick up Overmatch. Ty Benhoff does not do well when he's not the center of attention. Things start to get broken, and just stuff happens. So, he really likes it when he's in the spotlight, because after all, he is one of those special agents. So tonight, let's get to it, and let's talk to Steve Rizzeni. Steve Rizzeni served over 30 years as a paramedic in Toronto and as a tactical medic with the Ontario Provincial Police. He's an expert in chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosives incident response. Most recently, Steve was the commander of the Ontario Emergency Medical Assistance Team, the province of Ontario's Disaster Medical Response and All Hazards Incident Management Team. Steve is a recipient of the Governor General of Canada EMS Exemplary Service Medal and Bar in recognition of his more than 30 years of distinguished service and career accomplishments. Steve and his wife, Lynn, have two grown children, and he writes Alex Martel. So, Steve, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. I am wrapping up a perfect shot. The one thing that pops in my head is Alex Martel needs a movie deal. You've probably heard that before.
I have. Yeah.
Well, yeah, man.
I appreciate that too. So I do have representation in Los Angeles in Hollywood, and I know they started chopping it around last spring, right around the time the strike began. So I actually don't know what's going on, but no movie deal or small screen deal yet, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I don't know if you're the same way, but I'll like apply faces to characters, and I have no idea what the girl what her name is, but she was like the Knight of Flowers' sister in Game of Thrones, and I can't for the life of me. But like not diminutive, but relatively petite, but like just capable, like very like Alex is just that character is just. I just wondered, where she come from? Was she based on somebody, or did she just pop in your head one day and you're like, yeah, I'm writing her?
It's funny because Alex took a long evolutionary road, longer than I thought. So I hear how you are in terms of your thought process and your writing, and you sound like me. You don't sound like you outline a lot, that you're mostly a pantser and ideas come to you and you get them down, and then the characters speak to you and tell you where to take the story next. So that's me. And when I started writing, the very first Alex Martel manuscript wasn't published. Perfect shot. Technically, it's the first in the series, but it wasn't the first one I wrote. The first one didn't get picked up for publication. So when I started writing that one, that took me about 4 years to write, and then probably another couple that I spent editing it and massaging the character. So Alex took a long time to take shape fully. And then even years later, when I look back at some of my old writing, I found another character I'd started probably well, a couple of years before I started writing her story. And it was another character by the name of Rachel Danaher, who was an investigator that I set up with Interpol in, I think she was Amsterdam at the time. And it was basically, she was the beginning of Alex. So Alex took a long time to take shape. And that's after probably a number of attempts of writing male protagonists where, you know, whose stories kind of didn't go anywhere. But in terms of the inspiration for Alex, I mean, you work in the same line of work more or less that I do. I was a paramedic for 30 years. I was tactical with the Ontario Provincial Police for a number of years. I've worked with a lot of tough, capable, strong women, very competent in what they did, very, very competent and confident in what they did. One of my good friends is one of the first tactical, female tactical police officers in Canada, one of the first canine female canine officers in Canada, one of the first mounted, female mounted unit officers in Canada. I mean, you know, I worked with her. We never worked with her, but side by side, she was with Toronto Police. I was with Toronto Paramedic Services. We worked in the same area and we did calls constantly together where we would come onto the same scenes. So I got to watch her and I had so many examples like that. My wife, she's a long-term, my wife teaches a paramedic program in college and ran the program for basically 20 or 30 years. Super smart, super capable, confident woman. So those are the examples that I had for the last 30 years, just the people I work with. So in terms of informing the character, you know, I had lots of people who helped inspire and help grow Alex's character.
Yeah, I, you know, when you mentioned that, it was probably the same in Toronto and I hope it's changed over time, but I just remember, the women on the police department, we had same thing. On the narcotics unit, we had just fantastic investigators on the street. You know, we didn't care. It didn't matter. What sex you are, cop's a cop. If you're blue, you got my trust until you prove otherwise. Right.
Yeah.
But it always bugged me that, you know, no matter what, these cops were into, it would always come down to like, all right, we got a female's getting arrested. You got to be gone. You got to go to the booking area. You got to be the one to search her. You're the only female on the street tonight. So instead of out getting proactive and chasing down bad guys, you have to go babysit this drunk because we got nobody else. And it was like, always like unfortunate. Like that just, yeah. It's not like the opportunities weren't made available, but there was always that extra that they always got saddled with that I was just like, man, just let them go work, you know?
Yeah.
I really hope it's changing. I'm not on the streets, but I hope that has changed over time. And I think it has, hopefully.
I have to guess it has by sheer numbers, right? In the olden days, so to speak, you know, back when, you know, the 80s, 90s, whatever, it was there was one female officer or one female paramedic per 100 or per 200 or whatever, male officers or male paramedics or whatever, firefighters, you know, the whole public safety arena was dominated by men and women were slowly trying to kick those doors open or just nudge them open. But, you know, these days when I look at, again, I'm not working, I've been off the road now. Actually, this is my 10th year off the road. I left being a paramedic, an on-the-road paramedic in 2014. And at that time, I would say the ratio of female to male paramedics was almost 1-to-1. It was pretty close to 50%, yeah. if not maybe 40% female, 60% male. But it was certainly approaching the mark where it was pretty equal. And I would assume, and when, you know, even today when I walk, wherever I'm walking out in the community and I see police officers or, again, paramedics, I think it's pretty close to 50-50. So just by sheer numbers, I think hopefully the plight of female officers are not stuck, you know, babysitting in the jail cells anymore, the cell or whatnot.
Yeah.
So.
And because you could see how much it bothered them back, you know, but that was one of the many pet peeves I had that hopefully is better now. I don't think it's gone, but I hope it's better. But so that's, I mean, 30 years of experience and working with all these different people all go in to build this character. And so it makes me wonder, and As I said in my intro that my entire book changed, I'm a dead outliner.
Oh, are you?
I do. I have to, before I even type the first page, I got to have a hook and an end, and I can build the bridge in between. It's just for several of my books, I have that roadmap, and about 60% through the characters like, nah, we're going to take it this way. So yeah. that's where the panzer part comes from. But it made me wonder. You said that Alex's first book wasn't the one that got picked up. Did you start with her before you even started writing, or was it, here's a book, and as the plot builds, this is the character I'm putting in here, and she just kind of grew or evolved?
Yeah. So the way I write my characters and my stories really is the first two books I did zero outlining. I'm leaning more. I'm becoming more of a planter, you know, a plotter and a pantser.
Planter. Yeah.
I'm leaning more towards that because, you know, I think I'm probably wasting a lot of time at the end with a lot of editing, and I make myself miserable in between. You know, it's different now that I have a deadline. When you're writing for yourself and you don't know what the story is going to be or whether it's going to be picked up, you have the luxury of time. You can write for as many years as you want, but then when you have a book deal, suddenly you have a deadline and you better be somewhat more efficient at that. So a good friend of mine, Simon Gervais, who is another Canadian writer, an RCMP officer who has his own multiple series going on, also wrote in the Tom Clancy, or not the Tom Clancy, the Robert Ludlum space. Mm-hmm. You know, he suggested to me that I maybe try to plot a little more and outline a little more. So in the beginning, and to some degree still, I picture a situation. I have an image of my head of a character in a situation. With perfect shot, it was Alex in a ghillie suit laying on the forest floor, holding a rifle, looking through the scope. And I was just asking myself, well, what is she doing there? What does she see? What is she, you know, what happens next? And that's where it went. With the first book that didn't get picked up, it was a situation. I had set up a Christmas Eve situation with two characters in the story that weren't the protagonists. So they were people in the story that turned out to be, in a way, the bad guys of the story. And really, I was starting with a backstory of their lives and how they came to, in 15 or 20 years, do what they did later. And then the next scene I wrote was Alex, you know, humming a song, eating her yogurt, frozen yogurt, walking into her office. And it was the same thing again. I set up the one scene, but then, okay, who's now going to jump into this scene? And it was Alex, and I could see her, and she started to take shape in my mind, and, you know, her personality started to grow from what she did next on the page. So there wasn't a lot of thought given to it. Again, no planning necessarily around it being a woman or not. It just kind of evolved that way through the situations my character or characters found themselves in.
Yeah, that's wild. When you say that, like, I'm trying to think of, like, if I do that, if I see Alex in a ghillie suit, or here's, for one of the scenes in Blood Red Ivory, Ty Benhoff's first book, it was, I wanted to drop him in the middle of nowhere. We had no backup, and I knew I wanted to be in Zimbabwe because of another set of ancillary characters there. And I knew that I wanted him to do a crime scene by himself and either have a showdown with a lion or an elephant just to show, you know, that, you know, super tactical Timmy special agent doesn't matter at all when you're facing down a bull elephant. That just doesn't. Right. And I was like, how do I, but as I'm thinking about it, okay, if I just started with that, I think the way my mind works, I would have been like, okay, somehow he gets out of this, and then what? I would have just like run into a wall. So yeah, for your, the ability, when I talk to you and others that have that ability to just, you know, freestyle, that's a whole different channel that I don't think my brain has. But it makes me wonder with Simon being like, hey, you're on a deadline now. This is not for fun anymore. You have a career. Stick with the timeline. You might want to plan a little bit. Has that hurt your creativity at all? Or have you just kind of had to change the way of doing stuff?
It doesn't. It's a good question because I'm stumbling over it. So what I found is rather than have a full outline, I don't have a fully blown out outline or a fully shaped outline, but I kind of set myself maybe waypoints from point A. It used to be that, you know, I started with, I'm just in an open field and I have no idea which direction I'm going or what the terrain looks like or where I'm going and where I'm going to end up. That's how I used to start things. And then I kind of shifted a little bit to fairly soon after I get going, I do kind of set myself a target in the distance. I know I'm heading in that direction. I kind of know what's over there, but I don't know yet how I'm going to get there. Now for this, I'm working on the third in the series. And with that, I'm setting myself more waypoints. So I actually, interestingly enough, I don't have a final destination for this one. So I know where I'm starting. I kind of know where I want to go in the early parts of the story. You know, the waypoints that'll get me from here to there, but the distance is still a blur. So I'm not fully outlining. I'm not fully plotting. I have some idea where I'm going, but it really, my creativity isn't stifled because I still leave myself so much open-ended space to freewheel in that I'm not at that point yet. So my alarm keeps going off. So I apologize.
I don't hear it.
Phone here. Yeah.
I don't hear it, but yeah, that's interesting. It's kind of like, it's kind of like you're giving yourself an obstacle course, but you still, the open field metaphors is perfect. Cause I just picture my guy standing in an open field and like, which way do we go? Well, I don't know, whichever way the lion's not going, you know?
Exactly. Let's go the other way.
Let's go the other way of that. See what happens there. See what happens around that bend.
Yeah.
So your waypoints, do you follow the, you know, traditional 3-act structure, or have you found that, cause when I'm reading Alex, I see an adventure upon adventure upon adventure with, and I can kind of, as you're saying it, I can see the stumbling blocks that you give in Perfect Shot. Like as you're giving, this is a great conversation. Cause as I'm going back to when I was reading the book, I can see it, you know, trouble after trouble after win, loss, you know, along the way. And, but it still baffles me that you're winging all this out of your head, but you started in, let's see if I get this right. Started in Denmark, went to London, Paris, Turkey. I know I'm missing something. Just all the different ways across Europe that you made your way and ended up in DC. And I'm like, all of this just from a ghillie suit and a field. I'm like, man.
Well, and I think it has to do with, I appreciate that too. You know, I'm glad. I mean, Perfect Shot worked out. I'm happy. I'm obviously happy with the way the story turned out. And yeah, as I was writing it, it was just about feeling the rhythm of the story and knowing that when I read, I like to have moments of intense action, whether that's mental or whether that's a fight scene, but moments of intensity, I guess, followed by, you know, a pause where you can take a breath, or the reader, as a reader, I can take a breath. And as I was writing Perfect Shot, I just tried to duplicate or replicate that kind of waveform almost in the story. And it was, you know, I guess the trick is, it's hard to know because I've read so much Robert Ludlum, Tom Clancy, Nelson DeMille, all these, Brad Thor, all these great writers. And so you have the example in your mind of feeling those moments of ups, highs and lows and action and pause. And I just tried to kind of mimic that as I was writing, and then keep, as I was doing that, recognizing that it's not action for the sake of action, but action for the sake of moving the story forward. And then trying to tap into, well, where is my story going? And then kind of midway through Perfect Shot, it wasn't until I was about midway through that I knew what was going to happen in terms of what the big story would be. And that gave me more of a sense of, okay, well, I know what the big story is. Let's write towards the things that Alex has to do to resolve whatever that bad situation is going to be. And I don't know if it's, you know, I don't have any innate ability to write it, but it just, I think through experience and knowing what I like as a reader, I was able to sit down and write the story that I wanted to read. And again, you mentioned at the beginning, and I'm grateful for that. Grateful you mentioned cinematically, it pops in your head as, you know, feels like a movie to you. And that's very much how a story comes to me. I see it in my head as a movie as I'm writing it. So it's, to go back to your question, three-act structure, it's probably not a three-act structure. It probably, you know, more like TV these days, it's, you know, can be a seven-act structure or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's just enough moments in the story. I mean, like every story has a beginning, middle, and end. I just don't necessarily define it before I'm writing it or even while I'm writing it. But hopefully the story evolves in such a way that, you know, the intensity of the action escalates, and then at some point it starts to de-escalate and there's resolution at the end of the story. So
yeah,
I guess I must be doing something right though, but I'm not thinking too much about, you know, the story layout and plotting for sure.
I'm no expert, but it worked for me. but yeah, I asked that question because, you know, you could sit down with some writers and they're like, yeah, you know, I take this whatever three-act traditional structure, three-act, five-act, and I work the crescendo of this to this, then have a climax here. And I'm like, I look at it like I've read like Save the Cat, and I've read, you know, different books on writing, and they're fantastic, and I get something out of all of them. But when it comes down to me outlining my next book, I'm just like, I have no idea what this particular act is. I don't know if am I in the Empire Strikes Back act right now, or am I in the Star Wars, like A New Hope? I don't even know which act that is. Right. So that's why I asked. I do the same thing. I'm like, I got a hook, 'cause I want it to be, I got to kill somebody in the first 10 pages, or I get bored when I'm reading, and then, you know, ride that wave and then have an ending that people want to come back to see what happens next. Right. So, but yeah, I don't understand the three act structure, I guess, or it just doesn't compute. I don't know.
Yeah. And I'm in awe of people when I hear them talk about the story that way, like Robert McKee or the Save the Cat dude. I can't remember who that is. Blair. Is it Blair or somebody? Or I can't.
Yes.
Remember. My Story Can Beat Up Your Story by Jeff Schechter is another one. I'm in awe of people who can do that, but I'm not those people. So it actually brings me back to where this started. I started writing a novel in the 90s, mid to late 90s. And I got, you know, at the time I was counting pages, and I was about 70 pages in. I have a pretty good detective story set here in Toronto, an organized crime. It was actually kind of an Asian triad kind of organized crime story, because Toronto has a lot of organized crime and different crime groups involved. And I was seeing a lot of it back then. There was a big point in my career where I was involved, or I was responding to a lot of the aftermath of some of these battles.
Right.
Yeah. So I started writing a story that, and I got 70 pages into it, kind of hit this wall and didn't know where to go. And I turned to the common resources at the time, where internet wasn't, you know, this thing you could just Google, how do I write a story if I can't outline a book, you know?
Yeah.
And everything I found in the bookstores and online in bookstores was talking about outlining, and basically saying, if you're not outlining a story, you're not writing. And I thought, okay. And I gave up. I literally gave up based on that. Now, you know, I had life, the real things going on in life. I was raising, I had a young family, and I was focusing on that. So I suppose you could argue that it didn't mean enough to me to keep pushing through, but that's what happened. I couldn't find really good advice that suited me as a non-outliner, and I gave up. And it wasn't until 15 years after that, that I encountered some TV writing people, showrunners on a Toronto-based cop show called Flashpoint, or Toronto Origin.
Oh, I love that show.
Yeah, it was a great TV show. I remember that show.
It was a great show.
Yeah. And I met the creators of the show, Mark Ellis and Stephanie Morgenstern, who were the showrunners of it. And I was a tactical medic at the time, and I pitched them the idea of a tactical medic embedding with the tactical team. Mm-hmm. And they invited me to come talk to the show, the writers in the writing room, and went down and had a chat. Anyway, long story short, they obviously didn't incorporate a tactical medic in the show. They felt it would reduce the dramatic tension if they always had a medic there who could save someone's life if something bad happened. So great creative idea that they had. And when they learned that I was interested in writing, because that came up in the conversation, they just kind of scratched their heads and went, Well, if you want to write, Steve, just write. Don't listen to what people say or tell you how to do it. Yeah. Just go ahead and write. And that's probably the single best advice on writing I ever received is never mind what everybody says. Sure, educate yourself, you know, get to know how to write, what to write, when to write, whatever. But don't let anybody tell you that you're writing wrong, you know.
Yeah.
So you've got to be your own best voice when it comes to that kind of advice. And that was the best advice I ever got.
And the writing has to get a voice at some point. Like I think I'm 8 novels in, still figuring it out. But the last two I've been like, oh yeah, okay, I think I get what they mean by voice. Like, yes. Like it only took 6 novels to figure it out.
Well, know? And I, yeah, totally. Yeah. And I yeah. feel that now. I think, you know, I think I have found a voice with Alex and some of the other characters in the story. And the book that's coming out in November is called Out in the Cold. And I won't say who's in it because I don't want to, you know, ruin the surprise because there's a bit of some things left in the wind a little bit. It's not exactly as a cliffhanger at the end, but, you know, Alex's circumstances might or might not change. But I've been able to find a voice in other characters as well, where in the early days of my writing, I couldn't. And that was the stack that I have kind of this thick of stories I started that went nowhere. And largely that had to do with I couldn't find the voice while I was writing. So not just that I didn't have a real story or not just that I didn't outline, but I just couldn't find the voice of the character. And you're right. I think very much voice, if it's not underappreciated, it might be underappreciated by new writers, how important that is. And that it takes a while to find it. And the only way to find your voice, as you know, as because you just said it, you're 6 or 8 novels in, the only way to find your voice is by writing. And you don't write good stuff. No one's going to write. I'd be shocked if anybody ever wrote a masterpiece the first time they set out to write anything. I think, the world's best overnight successes have spent years or decades in the making by fleshing out bad writing, right? Getting it out there. You can't write good stuff until you've written a lot of horse manure, right? It's got to be the bad stuff comes out first. And eventually, as stuff comes out of you onto the page or the screen, you know, you hope over time it gets better as it's leaving your body. And then, of course, you can come back and edit it. But as it's leaving your body, your mind, whatever, you know, when you start putting pen to page, metaphorically speaking, it's going to be crap. And it only gets better with practice. Like anything else, you pick up a hockey stick or a football or a baseball, you're not suddenly Wayne Gretzky or, any great in any sport or any endeavor. You've got to be crappy before you can be good.
Yep. So. Yeah. And it's fun to, I mean, I probably should not have gone racing towards publishing the way I did, but it's interesting to me and I appreciate it. And I'll never change it. I know there's authors that will go out there and re-edit their books and put out a different edition. And I think that those have to stand, you know, scars and all, to see the evolution from the first book to the next book and however many more that come racing down the pipe of my brain at some point. But yeah, that evolution, hopefully you can see it through time when you read book to book to book. So yeah, I think it has to stand there as a kind of a caption of where you are in your development. And it's when people tell me they'll go back, change their book and then republish it, I'm like, God, don't do that. You're taking it away from people who can see the growth, you know. Yeah. I think.
Well, it also might be a sign, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful to anybody, but maybe the writing wasn't ready for prime time yet. Maybe they shouldn't have put it out there yet. And I think that's a hard discipline, and it's a hard skill to master. In the traditional publishing world, it's simple. If it's not ready, it's not going to get picked up. But if you're a writer, a person who's a writer decides to self-publish and go down that road, it takes a certain amount of discipline to know when it's finished. And you can certainly spend years over-editing anything, because I can look at Perfect Shot, for instance, or anything else that I've written in the past and really want to tinker. But you have to know two things. You have to know when it's not ready, it's you know, the it hasn't been in the oven long enough cooking, and you got to keep at it a little bit and finish, let it finish off a little bit, or a little stew on the stove, to really ruin a metaphor, you know. So yeah. It's maybe not fully cooked yet, so just leave it in there, or keep working at it, or do whatever you need to do to make it better. And the opposite is true too. Know when the end is near and it's time to stop tinkering and just make sure it's all wrapped up and all, you know, all your I's are dotted and T's are crossed and it's ready to go. And then, like you said, leave it alone forever. Yeah. You know, unless you're going to come up with an abridged version or something. Yeah, it's got to stand. Yeah. It's got to stand on its own. And it's got to stand as a testament to how, like you said, how you've grown as a writer.
Yep. I will add a cautionary note, though. I mean, in this day and age, with all the millions of small presses that are out there, there's, you know, they theoretically have their filter also, but just because it gets through that filter does not mean it should be published. Like there is a parasitic wave of small presses out there that probably don't help a new writer, that, you know, that's, but how do you tell somebody who wrote their first book that, hold on a second, right? You get a publisher that after 50 rejections, like, I love it. And they're like, okay. Right. Like a publisher just said, I love it. And then you realize that it's like a mom and pop working out of a trailer in mid Florida. They have no idea what they're doing. They're just trying to cash in on something. Right.
Yeah. And I don't know what the answer to that
it's
is.
It's a dangerous world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was pretty lucky because when I felt, you know, when I decided to take writing seriously, in other words, when I thought to myself that what I was writing might actually become something, and that was the first in the Alex Martell series that never went anywhere. So when I was midway through that and I realized I've got something here, then I focused on moving forward and finishing it and polishing it. And for me, part of that journey of knowing or convincing myself that it was, you know, it was good or worthy or whatever you want to call it, was I went to Thriller Fest, my very first Thriller Fest. So that was 2018. And that's where I started to face the rejections from agents and whatever else. And I went out and hired my own editor to help me make it better and polish it. So part of the journey for a writer is knowing what steps to take and maybe getting good advice. And some of the great advice I got, again, going back to Simon Gervais, who I met for the first time at my first Thriller Fest, was when I, in my head, I'm thinking, well, if I haven't got an agent and I haven't got this published in 6 months, I'm going to self-publish. And again, there's nothing wrong with self-publishing if that's the route you take. But he also knew that what I wanted to be a traditionally published author. And he just said, you know, hold your horses, take your time. It's a long game. It's not like being a paramedic or a cop. Things don't happen instantly. You know, there's no immediate gratification in this business. You know, it takes months, weeks, months, years for stuff to happen. It's a, you know, things move at a glacial pace. And it was Simon telling me repeatedly to be patient, that my story was good, my writing was good. It just took time to polish it, get it ready, and then for someone to recognize it and just keep going through the process to get it there. So that's, I luckily didn't have the temptation of going to, you know, finding a publisher who wasn't really top of their game, who had my best interests at heart as well. So I'm very lucky in that sense.
Yeah. Patience is, they don't teach us that. they don't teach us patience.
Yeah. And it's hard to be patient when someone's, you know, when you're facing down, in your case, you're facing someone down the end of a dark alley who's got, you know, something pointed in your direction. Or in my case, you know, you've got, let's say, an arterial bleed or a gunshot or their heart's not working. I don't have time to sit there going, I'm going to wait for a moment and see what comes to me. See if I get inspired. See if I can.
Yeah. I'll wait let's for have a meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should have a meeting. Let's set up a Teams meeting and discuss this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Well, it, you know, as we're talking, it makes me wonder, I had a notebook in my go bag from the day I reported to the police academy. I had a notebook in my go bag and it was full. I have reams of notebooks full of what exactly what you say, 70 pages of who's going to be the coolest police investigator ever to hit the page. And it just whoop, hit a brick wall. And I was like, no idea. And that, so were you that guy? Did you always have a book with you scribbling? Or
I did not when I was, no, I never did. I should have on the job. I didn't start doing that till, I guess I got my first computer and was taking the laptop to work and tapping away. But I was 20 years into my career before I started doing that. So, you know, the first story that I started in the 90s, I don't know, I guess I started that at home and I don't know why I started, but I didn't, I was never a notebook guy, I guess. I was, I very rarely did I write things down. I was more of a guy who needed to type things. Now, you know, early in my youth, I was a scribbler and I wrote short stories and poetry longhand. But when it came time to write the great American novel, you know, my great detective character, it didn't even occur to me to try that longhand. You know, Nelson, not Nelson DeMille. Daniel Silva. I'm looking at my bookshelf behind me. I can't believe Daniel Silva, he still writes longhand. And how many great writers are out there who do that? But that's, I could never do that. So
I've wanted to try it because it's, I thought the same thing. I'm like, I'll outline and I'll note and I'll sketch out everything in my notebook. And then I got to transfer it into Scrivener or whatever whatever I'm going to write with.
Yeah.
But I was talking to Mark Cameron last fall, and he was, when he starts a new book, he gets new notebooks and he writes it freehand.
That's right.
And I'm like, man, I'm like, would that add another level? Because I'm thinking, if I were to write it all out freehand and then type it into the computer, that's okay. There's first level editing. Cause not, you know, you're going to be scratching the crap out of that thing. Cause there's garbage. There's garbage in those pages. Yeah. Right. But I was like wondering, I'm like, man, I'm like, that's a lot of writing. I think the most I've written, I remember when I was finishing up my master's degree, there was a written piece and it was like 10 pages, probably 20 pages. It was a full notebook, 10 pages back to back, handwritten. It took hours. And I remember being like, man, my hand was numb at the end of it. It was insanity. I was like, I'm never doing that again. That's what keyboards are for. But no, like he was like, I'm going to write all this out. I'm like, whew.
That's Mark Cameron's he's a great guy. Super great guy. A really great writer. Every time I see him, you know, a post, he posts something and he's writing longhand or sitting in an airport writing longhand or whatever. I don't know how they do it. It's crazy to me. I mean, I have a notebook now. This is my, my thoughts and my notes. I do that now because it is a different process. You do tickle a different part of your brain when you write.
Yeah.
I'll take notes on the computer, but they're already organized thoughts. Whereas if I'm trying to brainstorm a problem or solve a problem, I have either this small notebook where I write a lot of my ideas down, or I have a full size sketch pad, like a giant artist sketch pad.
Oh yeah.
And I just scribble all over the thing and I have shapes and lines, and you know, that helps me when I'm problem solving or trying to work through a scene that's being difficult. And in a way it's like talking to somebody, you know, I get it out there. I can't do, it's funny because I can't brainstorm well on the computer, but I brainstorm well in like freehand.
Yeah,
it's the same as talking to my wife or talking to a friend about, what do you think of this? And they don't even have to give me their answer. It's just the act of getting it out, either verbally or sketched out or scribbled out on a page, sometimes help jar loose the idea, and it takes better shape that way.
Yeah, it's just funny walking through it.
Mind works. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the reasons I love doing this. I mean, I don't even know how many people listen to this, but every author I talk to has a different way of, you know, just getting all that stuff out of the brain and onto the page. And yeah, I mean, you guys come up with just the portraits that you build within the covers of a book are, you know, it's amazing. And everybody you talk to, it's like you talk to somebody and they're like, oh, you've written a book. And it's like, and they're like, how does that even work? 100,000 pages out of your head. And that's, you know, every time I talk to one of you guys, I get to hear a different version. You know, a lot of people come down into the categories of the pantser versus the outliner. Cool. But everybody's got a different way of doing it, right?
Yeah.
And then talk about you, the way you talk about Alex Martel, the way you know, Andrews and Wilson talk about their guys and talking to I've interviewed like 60 people on this thing, but everybody's got a different way and they've got a different passion of how they came about their guys. It's fascinating.
It really is fascinating. It kind of boggles the mind that people can have. I mean, there's one product, a book, but there's so many ways to go about it and so many variations on the theme. And it's even funny, you know, again, going back to the TV guys and the movie guys, the TV people I know who write are kind of mind blown that I can write a book. And here I am thinking, you guys have written seasons upon seasons of great TV shows. You know, every episode standing on its own as a great story leading to the next and on for five seasons or more or whatever. So don't be in awe of me writing a book, because I can't imagine how you do it, you know. But it's not, you know, it's similar to professions of any kind. I'm a paramedic. That's what I did for 30 years. I did variations on a theme by being tactical or being whatever else. But I talk to other people who say to me, you know, like I have friends and neighbors who are teachers. And throughout my career, and I'm sure you've heard this, I don't know how you do that job. And then you hear what their job is and think, I don't have a clue how you do yours, how you can sit in the classroom, at the front of a classroom filled with 14 or 16 year olds and actually communicate an idea and not lose your mind, you know, right. or whatever it is, or yeah. some other job.
Strangle somebody.
Yeah. Or some other job that is probably a great job, but I don't know how they do it or why they'd want to, you know, whereas you and I look at our professions and go, we're super comfortable with what we do. So right. it's funny how people find their comfort zone in whatever it is. And in writing, it's certainly the same thing. It's the myriad ways that people come up with to come up with a story, think of a story, or just write through a story without knowing anything about it is, it's really fascinating as a study of how the brain works.
Yeah, the psychology of it's amazing, but it's funny. I think of screenwriters and I'm like, I don't understand. Like, I can't even decipher what a screenplay looks like. I can't even write a short story. I couldn't wrap up a beginning, middle, and end in 5,000 words. I need 100,000 to get, you know, the wordiness out of me. But it's funny, the career thing always comes up at my house because I've got a nurse. I've been in law enforcement. I went down the EMT track. I was certified EMT for a while too, because I was just fascinated by it. I loved the idea, you know, and I got to practice a little, not enough, but at my house, like if I walk in and my wife's watching TV, if it's not a true crime, like serial killer movie that she's way into for some reason, it's like one of these like plastic surgery shows or some medical show where there's like a doctor taking a chisel to some woman's face. And I just get nauseous and she'll look at me. She's like, what is wrong with you? I'm like, you could hit somebody with a bus and give me a trash bag and I'll go pick up every piece without a problem and then wonder where lunch is. But when I see that first purposeful incision on a body, I'm like, nope, I just can't do it. Like, yeah. I don't know where that switch is, but she's like, I don't understand how squeamish you get about this stuff. And I'm like, I don't either. Cause there's definitely a difference between trauma and purposeful surgery.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, it's odd because I've worked in, I worked in the field for 30 years plus. I actually worked in a hospital as a paramedic in an emergency department for a couple of years. I've done a ton of clinical work in ORs and whatnot. As part of my training, I've spent a lot of time in operating rooms. And like you, give me a subway jumper or an apartment jumper and I can manage the gruesomeness of it. But I really don't actually like seeing people get cut into, whether it's autopsies or surgery. But it's what you get used to. You know, it's what your brain feels is within the realm of normal, right? And if it's outside that scope, then it's gonna freak you out a little bit. So,
yeah. And it was even weirder because I go to an autopsy all day long. I'm fascinated. The pathologist wants to hand me a saw. I'm in, like, just give me a coat. Cause I don't like the one, the bone chips hit me, but like the surgery gets me, but you can dissect the body. I'm cool with it. A jumper, fine. But there's something about a human being living there and being taken apart and put back together. That not right. That's not right. But you know, getting away from the gross stuff, back to writing. I was interviewing Taylor Moore, and he's into both fields. Like he can take his story and expand it to 100,000 plus words, but he can also, you know, boil it down to that outline form of a screenplay. And that's, again, if I ever figure out the psychology of this, is probably when I'll be like, yeah, I'm done with the podcast. But until everybody's got there's a whole different way people think, I don't see how I don't stop being fascinated by the conversation, you know?
Yeah. And Taylor's a good friend of mine, actually. If you read Out in the Cold, you'll see there's a character in my story named after him. I have a Taylor Moore in my story.
Oh, nice.
It's not based on Taylor Moore, but named after Taylor Moore. So, well, it's interesting because, you know, I talk about the roots of who encouraged me to get back into writing. So my first foray back into writing was trying to write screenplays. And so I taught myself screenwriting. I went to a screenwriting seminar, or two. I went to a screenwriting conference, like a 3 or 4 day screenwriting conference here in Toronto. So I taught myself screenwriting, bought myself Final Draft, dabbled with some, again, same way, just started typing away, writing some really bad stuff that didn't go anywhere. And then I made a concerted effort to try to write something from beginning to end. So I wrote a pilot, a TV pilot, like a series TV pilot. Of course, it didn't go anywhere. But I played and dabbled in that medium for a while. And the one thing it taught me was I could go from start to finish with something slightly longer than a short story. And so that was the one real benefit of coming into screenwriting, was knowing that I could start something and figure my way out till the end and get to the end. And that was I guess it was about a 60-page screenplay. But that was the first time I wrote a full anything other than, again, going back years when I was a kid writing short stories or whatever, but, you know, a full longer piece story of any kind. That was it. As a matter of fact, the first Alex Martel story that became, again, the number one in the series that never went anywhere, it started as a screenplay. I was writing it as a screenplay, and I got out to 30 pages or so, which is, you know, is about 25% of a feature film. Mm-hmm. Got out to about, well, I was probably writing it too long because I was nowhere near a quarter through the film if it was going to be a movie. But I realized I liked the story and I liked how the characters were setting up, and I wanted to take it. I thought, I want to write it as a novel. And that's what I did. So I took that 30-page screenplay and then rewrote it as a novel and finished it. And that became, you know, it was called By a Long Shot, was the first manuscript. And that was the first in the Alex Martel, but it started as a screenplay.
Yeah. And the way my brain works, when I look at a screenplay, if I look at my outline before I start a book and look at a screenplay, they're very similar. So it'd be, I'm like, hey, I already got most of my outline done. Let's just start typing.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
But exactly. you mentioned, side note, you mentioned, dropping Taylor into Out in the Cold, and I had a couple notes in the margins as I was reading. I had to ask how much of a Star Wars fan you are.
Not much, I'd say.
No, because I there's two, as I'm reading, there were two references in there, and I'm like, is he a Star Wars fan? Because you have Yoda dropped in the first part, and then as I'm reading, I hate bringing stuff up sometimes because you don't want to give a spoiler away, but you drop my favorite jet, an A-10 Warthog, into the book, which I appreciate very much. Yeah. I think anytime an A-10 Warthog shows up, I don't think anything can go wrong when you're a writer. Might go wrong for the characters, but as far as the person reading it, it's like, yeah, let's get some. But as you drop that in and somebody says, I've got a bad feeling about this, and that was like, ding, I was like, huh, there's another one. So yeah, I was like, well, is he just dropping Easter eggs, or is this just natural?
Yeah, no, for Star Wars, you know, the first Star Wars, a huge fan of. I was, what was that, 1977? I was a teenager. Yes. I lined up like everybody else. I thought it was fantastic. And I was a huge Yoda fan, you know, I thought, mm-hmm. and I think part of the reason I'm a Yoda fan is I always loved the martial arts and respected martial arts and the discipline of the samurai and all that. So Yoda was a miniature foreign samurai, right? So I love that character. I love his thinking. I love the way he said things. So that stuck with me. I can't even remember the exact line as what is it exactly? It was a do or do not moment. Yeah, exactly.
There's no try.
And so, yeah, that just came to me. And I thought, do I take that out because it's a little corny? I thought, no, I'm going to leave it in there. And then the warthog thing, I'm not sure how that evolved, but I got some, there's an A-10 warthog pilot who I mentioned in my acknowledgments. Her name is Casey Campbell. So Kim, Killer Chick Campbell.
Killer Chick Campbell, yeah.
Yeah. And she graduated, she left the military as a full bird colonel. But at the time she was, she had some pretty highly dramatic moments over Baghdad, when she was almost shot down. Her A-10 was shot to pieces basically. And she and her wingman made it back to base, luckily. But somehow I stumbled on her, you know, while I was perusing the internet or Twitter one time, and I actually sent her the pages where the A-10 is in the story. I sent her those pages. And she read through them and gave me some ideas or told me if I was going wrong or told me what I was doing right or suggested some things. So I had some real great buy-in from a real A-10. I would say she's a legend. I mean, how can you not admire that particular aircraft? The capabilities, the purpose.
Yeah. Sadly, it all started with me and G.I. Joe, and it was bad guy's plane. They just look so cool. Yeah. You know, back in the day, the 80s, I was a child of the 80s.
And it looks a lot like, what was that? Didn't Luke Skywalker, whatever their aircraft was kind of like a hovercraft, but in a way, it kind of looked like an A-10 almost.
Like an A-10. Yeah. Just that toothy grin on the front of it. It's like, yeah, that thing's just cool. Yep. But yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just, as I was reading though, I was like, there's another one. I was just like, cause you know, people like to drop their little nuggets in there. And it's like, maybe I caught them. Maybe I found something.
Well, let's say that I'm a big fan of the first one, but it tapered off after that. I haven't been keeping up. I'm not, I didn't watch the Mandalorian and all that. I'm not big into sci-fi anymore like I used to be, but the first one was iconic.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. It
super influential back in the day when, you know, as any young person watched that movie, how could you not be affected and excited by that whole story and medium and the special effects of it all back in the 70s, it was miraculous almost.
Oh yeah. It was a game changer. And I've got the little kids now, so the 11 and 7 year old, it's pretty much all Star Wars all day at my house. Star Wars and Legos, so it's further up in the forebrain here.
Yeah.
I completely lost my train of thought. We started talking Star Wars and everything just just went away.
No worries.
I had a question. I wanted to know, Perfect Shot. The first one that didn't get published, were there, did you have, scenes like you have your action scenes in that one where you just like, it was so hard to leave on the shelf, or were there stuff that you were able to pluck from the first one and move into Perfect Shot, or are you just waiting for the moment for that first book to come around?
Yeah. Interesting on a couple levels, because a little bit of all of that, I would like to. So in Perfect Shot, I don't think I borrowed anything but the characters and maybe one short snippet, an exchange between Alex and her boss at Interpol, Martin Brassard. There may have been a little bit there, but it had to be, even it didn't have the same effect in Perfect Shot when I kind of picked it up and plunked it in and tried to massage it and write it in because it was a good character moment. But because there was more that led up to that moment in the original, it didn't have the same effect. So it was almost not worth doing what I did, cutting it and pasting it in, even though it's not the same scene in the end. It changed quite a bit. So that's not always easy to do. And in out in the cold, I might have borrowed a couple of things, but same thing. It required a lot of massaging to get it in there. But it's because I felt it was good and appropriate as opposed to just wanting to grab something and throw it in there. But to the last thing you said, I still have thoughts that maybe it'll be a standalone in the future. I mean, it would have to be, it would take me, I don't even know what the effort would be required to make it a future Alex Martell story, because obviously, you know, it was written as the first, and it quite honestly wasn't exactly, you know, it wasn't a perfect thriller. It was probably a hybrid of different genres, and I haven't read it in years, so I'm not sure how good or bad it is, but I like the bones, the backbone of the story is good. I like what the story's about. I like the characters in the story. So I can see taking that story and completely massaging it into a new version of its former self. That might be something fun and cool to do.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting, interesting exercise.
Yeah. And but it would never come off the shelf, you know, in as it sits. I mean, I was talking to Robert Dagoni, who's a great writer out in Seattle. He has a number of great series on the go. And Bob was generous enough to read, by a long shot, actually, and offered to blurb that, and ended up blurbing Perfect Shot as well. And when I told him, so we went out with By a Long Shot the first week COVID hit New York. So whether it might have been picked up was hard to know, because my agent said, you know, we should pull this back because New York is crazy right now. All the offices are closing down. We don't know what's going to happen. You don't want to send this out to 5 or 10 or 20 people, have them all rejected and come up with a new one in short order, because then your name is associated with something they've already rejected. So that was all great advice. And we pulled it back, and then Perfect Shot went out in its place. But at the time, Bob said, you know, don't feel bad. Don't worry that By a Long Shot wasn't picked up. He says, I had lots of stories in the drawer, so to speak, when I started writing. And he says, I don't have anything left in the drawer anymore. Because at some point, publishers came around saying, what else have you got? What else have you got? So you hope to have that kind of luck. You don't know if that's going to happen, but you hope to have that kind of luck. So I can see Perfect, or I can see that first one coming out, but not in the version that it sits right now on the shelf.
Yeah, it's never wasted effort, because you're still learning as you go.
Totally.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, I've had you about an hour, and I try not to keep people in the middle of the week for more than an hour, because everybody's got lives and stuff. But before you go, when I have you know, civil servants on or veterans on, I always ask the same question. And given your 30 years of service, you got a 17, 18 year old kid coming out of high school trying to decide, do I take that step into the life of a civil servant, EMS, fire, police, military? What's your advice for him?
Oh, you know, I would always say, you know, for me, becoming a paramedic was a calling. I wanted to become a cop. My first choice was to become a police officer ever since I was like 8 years old, but I didn't have the eyesight for it at the time. And when I started my career as a paramedic, I had still tried to be a police officer first, but couldn't because of my eyesight. But I wanted to be a paramedic. I loved that too. So either would have been great with me. Turned out to be 40 years in public service. Never easy, but no job is probably supposed to be easy. There's challenges along the way. But to me, it was a calling. And I would think that anybody that wants to have a worthwhile life, a worthwhile existence while they're here, I think public service is a great way to go, whether that's the military, whether that's in one of the public safety agencies or in healthcare or whatever it is. I really would encourage people to look for something they'd love to do in that public service realm. But things are harder these days than when we started our careers. It's a lot harder. Oh, yeah. So it's a tough question. They have to really hear that calling loud to answer it, because it's I think the challenges are a lot different and probably, you know, maybe exponentially more difficult than the challenges we faced, with far more oversight, scrutiny, second guessing everything people do. So it's a tough question to answer. Sorry, I couldn't be more help with that one.
Nope. I think it's perfect. I think at the end of the day, if you know, a life where you can look back and know you made a difference is that goes a long way. So, and it's hard to see when you're 17, 18 years old.
Totally.
So I appreciate the answer. I think it was great.
Thanks.
But before I let you go, I've got steverzenny.com and then very consistent across the socials at steverzenny.
Yeah, exactly.
X, Instagram, and Facebook.
Absolutely. Yeah, drop by. Anybody can drop by. I love it. I do receive random notes and emails from my website or direct messages on social media. I try to respond. I do like getting those messages from people. So by all means, people can reach out and grab me on any of those platforms.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you joining me tonight.
And thanks, John. This is great.
I hope when Out in the Cold comes out, you come back and join me again.
I'd love to. Thanks very much. And good luck with all your writing too.
Awesome. Me too. All right. Good night, everybody.
Thanks. Good night.